Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Academy of Spirituality and Paranormal Studies and can be found on the web at www.aspsi.org. Tonight's guest is Dr. Stephen Iacoboni, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 888-815-9756, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
Hello, Fran. And I know you've been very busy this week, working frantically, getting set for making arrangements for Las Vegas, which we'll be can tell our listeners they can hold the dates because the conference is going to be this year, our annual conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, on the weekend of November 12th and 13th.
Correct.
And we've got a pretty good lineup of presenters already with more to come. And I know that you've been negotiating some fabulous room rates. And I would imagine people might want to extend their stay, so the hotel would...
Right, the hotel will honor those rates in either direction, even though we don't actually have the hotel yet. Both hotels that are in the final running have both agreed to honor those rates in both directions, so anybody can make an extended vacation out of being in beautiful and crazy Las Vegas. And it's going to be wonderful.
Yeah, and I would imagine within the next week we'll have that those arrangements set, and then we could give you more specifics, check the website. We'll be talking about it on the radio as
well. Right, but my warning to everybody is to mark those dates and start to plan. Apparently, Las Vegas in November is big conference time, and the hotels and everything fills up. So we've got our block, and, you know you want to go, I think you got to jump on it quickly. So that's our November story.
And coming up well before that, in May.
Noon in May is our weekend afterlife exploration retreat in Chester, Connecticut. And if you think Chester, Connecticut is too far, we've been to this place before. It's easily accessible by plane, train, or automobile. And it is gorgeous. You are in the country. It's just a beautiful, beautiful setting. And in May, it's going to be delightful.
Right. And the name of this retreat?
Transforming Grief into Hope and Understanding.
Okay. So it's a little bit different than some of our other events. You know, with it's very specific in nature. I mean,
And not only that, we're limiting the total size to 50 people. And to make it even more hands-on, during the time we are there, we're going to break those 50 people into smaller groups. And they will rotate in smaller groups into two-hour sessions with each of the four facilitators that will be teaching and giving them hands-on workshop in various areas. So we will be covering dream visits. We'll be covering induced after-death communication, grief recovery. We'll have medium spirit communication and psychic empowerment, amongst a bunch of other stuff that we'll be doing as a larger group.
Yeah, and well, you've got a lot of other interesting things planned, panels where you can ask questions. We have
wonderful
movies to show,
we're gonna be
and some sharing. And so it's
And delicious, delicious food.
Yeah.
Because if you're worried about going places because you have food allergies or any kinds of problems, we have our own personal chef. Everybody fills out a food form, what they like, what they don't like, what they like to eat, and any allergies they have or restrictions, and our chef will be catering to us during that beautiful weekend.
So, you know, people can find out more about that. If there was an insert in the last newsletter, but they can always go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org, and all the complete details are there, as well as the instructions for making a reservation. So we're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to have a wonderful guest, Dr. Stephen Iacoboni. So stay with us, and we will be back in 2 minutes, so take care.
Hello, I am Lloyd Auerbach, parapsychologist and author. You can learn much more about life after death, precognition, mind-matter interactions, remote viewing, ghost hunting, and other psychic experiences and research through the acclaimed Distance Learning Parapsychological Studies program at HCH Institute. Our courses are audio-based with additional written and video material. Call HCH at 925-283-3941 or visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com. Our courses include The Search for Life After Death, Being Psychic, Psychokinesis and Precognition, Ghost Hunting, Theories and Models of Psychic Experience, and more. Taken singly or as part of the certificate program, these courses will enrich your knowledge of parapsychology and the range of psychic phenomena. You'll learn about being psychic yourself. Visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com or call 925-283-3941 for information about our individual distance learning courses and certificate program.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Winbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Winbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.winbridge.org.
After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world, but for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential, and research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The sign registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Stephen Iacoboni. Our sponsor is the Academy of Spirituality and Paranormal Studies and can be found on the web at www.aspsi.org.
And our guest tonight, I'd like to welcome Dr. Stephen Iacoboni. He served as fellowship in medical oncology at the prestigious MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, where he received the Outstanding Researcher Award. He was honored to present his research findings at the American Society of Clinical Oncology. In 1989, Dr. Iacoboni co-founded St. Mary's Regional Cancer Center in the state of Washington, where he practiced medicine for 16 years. He later accepted the position of medical director at the Kootenai Cancer Center in Idaho in 2001. And in 2010, he returned to Washington to co-direct the Kennewick General Hospital Hematology Oncology Program. His book, which we'll be discussing today, is called The Undying Soul, A Cancer Doctor's Discovery. And welcome, Dr. Iacoboni.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And great to have you. I did read the book. I enjoyed it very much. And incidentally, the website people can go to is www.theundyingsoul.com. There is a link, an Amazon link on our website to purchase the book. So, Dr. Iacoboni, as a medical doctor, you know, specializing in cancer, obviously the nature of your work involves the treatment of many patients who unfortunately, you know, die from the disease. Many patients speak about a tremendous amount of fear and anger about dying. And in the book, you talk about an unspoken conspiracy of silence when it comes to the subject of death. Can you explain a little bit what you meant by that?
Oh, sure. I think it's an important subject. Many patients want to be told what they want to hear, which is to say that they want to come in and be told that there's a cure or an effective treatment that's going to solve their dilemma. And even sometimes if a doctor wanted to be brutally honest, it would be sort of counterproductive, at least initially. But at the same time, doctors are sort of in the same boat. It's kind of hard to have someone come into your showroom and say, well, our cars aren't very good, you shouldn't buy one. You want to say, well, we have an effective treatment for that, we can make you better, and go from there. And so having the hard conversation about treatment futility and hopelessness is a very difficult conversation to have. And we're not trained as medical professionals to have that conversation. We're trained to find some sort of remedy and give it and hope for the best. And beyond that, there's always a 1 in a million chance that some new treatment will work. And so it's easier to say, let's try something else, rather than to say, you know, I really think it's time to talk about end-of-life issues. And so the conversation often gets overlooked, or not overlooked, but deferred until it's too late.
Mm. And I guess we live in a society that where there is also this conspiracy of silence, so to speak. I mean, people do everything to avoid the subject.
Oh, absolutely, and that's part of it. I mean, it is a larger social collective acknowledgement that there's not much talk about it, and there's always got to be some sort of favorable outcome at the end of the movie. And we don't even slaughter our own meat anymore. We get meat wrapped in plastic and cellophane, and we don't know that it came from a cow or a pig or a chicken. We just take it and cook it up. And when people get sick, they don't stay in the home and get taken care of. They get whisked off to the medical center until they're better. And so it's all been put to the side and hidden away, swept under the rug. And then when you can't do that because you or your loved one has cancer, then all of a sudden you're unprepared for it.
Mm. I enjoyed reading the saga of your professional and personal life. Here you were totally immersed in the world of science, a bright young, researcher and medical doctor, and I suppose you thought that, you'd be able to you'd be the one to cure the disease. As you point out, it was all about science and empirical evidence and things like intuitiveness or contemplation of what your patients were feeling were not exactly in your realm of thinking.
No, in fact, I remember vividly 35 years ago when I started my training, my professor said, well, you better be thinking about what you're going to do later in life because 10 years from now, cancer will be cured. So we're saying, in other words, 25 years ago, we were supposed to have cured cancer. And this was either a delusion or a mythology, whatever you want to call it, or let's just say, to be kind, a miscalculation. But there was this euphoria about what was going on and what we were going to accomplish. Now, this was a time in American society when things were really happening, and we landed men on the moon. We had John Kennedy in the White House and so on. It was an exciting time. There all the period of liberation of the 60s and so on and all the fun that went on there. It seemed like, you know, America was really coming into its own after the Second World War and the Korean War, and we, let's not mention Vietnam, but we were sort of the kingpin in the world, and everything was going our way, and so why couldn't we just find a few chemicals to kill cancer and then go have a beer?
Right.
And of course, that never happened.
Oh.
that never happened. Cancer is just as difficult to treat now as it was a long, long time ago. You know, and when you see technology around us advancing so rapidly that you can't even keep up with it, from jet planes to iPods to your TV to your TiVo and so on, that you think, well, what's wrong with these biochemists? I mean, why can't they put a few molecules together and do this thing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the whole organic world, the whole biological world is just vastly more complicated than we ever imagined.
Mm. And you developed some very close patient relationships. I don't know if that's common to all cancer doctors, but certainly in your case, you developed personal relationships with many of your patients. And I felt your anguish as you recognized, you know, their fear and the horror that they were experiencing at the prospect of dying. So I guess this affected you personally.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, some oncologists get more emotionally invested than others. I was one who early on thought, well, I'm a scientist and I'm a technician and I'm a researcher. And but I found very quickly that I couldn't keep those walls up. Patients, in the end, are patients, and they're sick, and they want you to help them in whatever way you can. And so I found that the only way to make my work bearable was to embrace the warmth and the compassion and the closeness that they wanted from me. And actually, when I did that, my life got a lot easier, because then I was their friend and their confidant and their mentor and their doctor, and there wasn't any tension anymore. And I found that that I was doing everything I could, and when things went a certain way, it was very difficult. But, you know, there was always a constant flow of new patients to distract you from too much grieving.
Mm-hmm.
But this closeness did lead me to a number of steps along the way in terms of spiritual ascendancy. And so I'm grateful that I made that choice.
Yeah. I know that in the work that we do, we find that it often takes a tragedy like the loss of a loved one before someone starts questioning the possibility of life after death. So did you find that this was also the case in those that discovered that they had a terminal illness? That trauma prompted them to search meaning?
Well, it was actually maybe not quite that way. What happened, you know, is that in cultural narrative, up until about 1970, most everyone went to church and most everyone believed in an afterlife. And then there seemed to be a breakdown in that belief system. Certainly that sort of thing has happened in Western Europe over the past 50 years. And my patients, quite to the contrary, who were all churchgoers, had quite a bit of fear and doubt, even though they were regular churchgoers. And you would think, well, I went to church and the priest said I'll going to go to heaven, and so I don't have anything to worry about. And I think everyone was comfortable with those feelings up until 1970, so to speak. And then after that, we all began to question our traditions. And certainly the media, from then up until now, at every chance it gets, it ridicules tradition and ancient belief. I mean, you have movies like Religulous and other people just making fun of all of the old-fashioned things that we all grew up believing in the 50s. And that has an effect on people. I mean, you have the announcer at the Olympics asking Kobe Bryant if he feels a little corny about being patriotic when he won the gold medal in basketball, and Kobe Bryant looked at him like he was crazy. But
yeah,
the media is doing everything it can to break down our traditional values, and whether you say to yourself, I don't believe in that stuff, it still has an impact. It creates a seed of doubt, and when you're dying, you know, you're at your weakest. And if you're not really, really steadfast in your faith, fear and anguish can overwhelm you.
Well, I from your book, I realize that you discovered, you know, that a belief in survival of consciousness and a belief in a soul or an afterlife, that could be, you realize it could be extremely helpful to the people that were dying. And I think you came to that realization from several patients that taught you. I know one that came to mind was a patient you had, Pavel, can you talk a little bit about him and what he taught you?
Well, sure, and let me just lay the groundwork a little bit further. When my father died in 1964, I was a devout Catholic, and even though it was a personal tragedy, we were all quite confident that he had gone to heaven and that we would see him in the afterlife. And then 15 years later, my mother died of breast cancer in 1977, and by then we'd all become agnostics or atheists, and we didn't have any such hope that she was going to go to heaven. And so I had the upbringing and the experience to know about the traditional belief that human beings are born with a soul and that there's an afterlife. And then I became a great intellectual, at least in my own mind, and rejected that notion because it seemed too old-fashioned. So I knew that those ideas existed. I just found them intellectually a little simplistic, and so intellectuals are always trying to make fun of people who have common sense beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So Pavel was about as non-intellectual and commonsensical a person as you could find. He was a victim of the Chernobyl disaster. He was a grain farmer from Ukraine. He came to the United States because Tom Foley was Speaker of the House in Eastern, and his district was in Eastern Washington, you know, the Spokane district, and he got a State Department dispensation, and we had a little small Russian community in our town that brought him over. And Pavel was a man of utter and complete and total faith. He was almost like Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, he never in the entire time did anything but smile and show serenity throughout his very grueling and difficult experience as a cancer patient. And I was deeply moved to see this kind of demonstration of faith. It was deeply inspiring, and it really got me thinking.
So, I mean, actually, in the way that he was reacting, which was so different than a lot of your other patients, was that the key to your finally making some sense of what you were experiencing every day? Was it developing a new perspective on things?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. To elaborate further, I had found that practicing as I was in the 80s and 90s that the majority of my patients, who were all basically churchgoers, were still, even with their faith, they were scared. And they were full of anguish, and I didn't know really quite what to say or do for them. At the time, I was still an agnostic, and so I just kind of was confused, and I was looking for an answer because I still wanted to make them feel better, even though, you know, it's hard to soothe an existential woe just by words. But Pavel came along, and he showed me the kind of faith that I had seen regularly as a in my childhood when I was, you know, I said I grew up in a Roman Catholic family, and faith was very strong, and he reminded me of what the power of faith. And here was this man who had been basically killed by his government's mistakes, and the government there would not even treat him. They sent him home to die. He found his way to America by a series of providential actions. And he had no bitterness, and he had no fear, and he had no angst. And I was, it's sort of like the brave man on the battlefield makes all the scared soldiers go, oh, yeah, I guess we could behave differently. We could follow our leader, and maybe we could perform at a higher level. And, you know, when you're surrounded by fear and anguish all the time, and then in walks someone who's on a whole different spiritual plane, it's like he's got a halo around him. And so I was really drawn to his strength.
Yeah.
And the thing about it was that he was, you know, materially, he was not very impressive at all. He was short, and he wore shabby clothes, and he couldn't speak English, but none of that mattered. He was like a prophet of some kind.
So, you know, as you observe your patients, I would imagine when that final reality sinks in, you know, that medical science can no longer offer any hope, that's really the real tragedy there, that the loss of hope. And what you were searching for, I guess, was a way that you could offer hope, something that would transcend your abilities as a scientist.
Well, that's exactly right. The majority of medical oncologists, I think, simply go on treating their patients until they die and never have that conversation about, gee, it's time to think about end of life. But I don't think that's fair to the patient. They don't get any benefit out of it. They don't get any guarantee time with their family and their loved ones. This charade of, well, we'll somehow fix this when everyone knows it can't be fixed, keeps going on until the patient's dead. And so I realized that I didn't want to do that, and so I had to find a way to be the emotional, spiritual leader for my patients, which was something at first I thought was peculiar. But actually, there's a lot written now in a lot of contemporary sociology about how people go to their doctors for this kind of affirmation and support. It actually makes a lot of sense if you were to be a fly on the wall and see the kind of relationship that builds over time. Patient comes in, they're dying, you treat them, you reverse the process, you looked upon as some kind of miracle worker, not an ordinary person by any means, and so you become the most important person in their life, other than, of course, their close loved ones. And you are the answer man, and you are the one who understands the world of technology. And then they think, well, maybe you know things about the world and life and God and all those other things. You become their mentor on a lot of levels other than their medical mentor. And again, I was reluctant to walk down that path. I didn't even know it was appropriate. But I finally realized that was the expectation, and that's what other people were experiencing. And I decided I had no choice because my patients really wouldn't let me out of it. You know, they would say, what's going to happen to me when I die? And if I said, well, I don't know, you know, they would, that's not what they expected from me, you know. And so I knew I had to have answers. And so I decided to rethink my own agnosticism and the startling thing was, the more I researched it, the more I realized that I myself had allowed myself to be misled by a certain level, a certain group of intellectuals who dominated the discourse in the 60s and 70s and tried to talk us all into atheism and sold best-selling books around the world and got everyone in that direction. And I followed them, unfortunately, and I realized they were wrong and I was wrong, and I had to change my beliefs.
Mm. Now, one of your patients described his near-death experience to you, including, you know, one of the some classic common themes, and in this case he was being pulled towards a bright light. Now, I would imagine that you don't have too many patients that have had, you know, NDEs, because I guess, frankly, you're usually not taking resuscitative action, you know, with a lot of the patients. But was that the only patient that described an NDE to you, or do you have other patients that have had near-death experiences?
Well, at the time of the writing of the book, he was the only one. And yeah, you're right, it's for that very reason. We don't resuscitate our patients, and so they don't have, you know, a heart attack or a car accident. I don't take care of people in those settings typically. And his NDE was long, long ago before I'd met him. It's interesting. Since that time, I've actually now had the opportunity to talk to two other patients who've had NDEs, and it's pretty fascinating. But, you know, this one was really particularly interesting and impressive because, you know, I suppose anyone could read a book about that subject and then go into their doctor's office and make up a story.
Right.
But this guy was the most down-to-earth, the most uneffacing and unassuming person in the universe. And he had nothing to gain by impressing me in that way. He never tried to be anything other than who he was, which was Clarence the janitor. But the fact that he'd worked on the pipeline, and of course they had to eat canned food in those days, and then you get botulism from that, his story was unassailable.
Mm.
And the other thing about it was, you know, if he'd made the whole thing up, then when he faced his death, he would have not been the way he was, because he was just a plain old guy. He was a janitor, he was divorced, he lived alone in an apartment, and he was dying alone other than his son was with him, and he was had a big smile on his face, and you can't fake that.
No.
And he said to me, he said, "I've already died once, Doc. I know what it's like, and it ain't that bad."
Yeah, there goes the fear of death. Yeah. What we're going to do is go to a break. When we come back, we'll be continuing this conversation with Dr. Iacoboni, the author of The Undying Soul, A Cancer Doctor's Discovery. So stay with us, and we will be back in a few.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, The AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is atransc.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Welcome back to Signs of Life Radio, and what we are going to do is continue our interview with Dr. Iacoboni. First, we do have an announcement. The Academy of Spirituality and Paranormal Studies will be holding their annual conference, Spirituality, Science, and the Paranormal, from June 2nd through June 5th, 2011, on the campus of Kutztown University in Pennsylvania. The conference will feature inspiring presentations from some of the leaders in the fields of spirituality and non-physical reality and provide attendees with new insights on a variety of spiritual and paranormal topics. Conference details can be found by visiting their informative website, www.aspsi.org, or by calling 860-242-4593. That's 860-242-4593.
If you are just tuning in, our guest here tonight is Dr. Stephen Iacoboni. This show is sponsored by the Academy of Spirituality and Paranormal Studies and can be found on the web at www.aspsi.org. If you are business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to Dr. Iacoboni, we have a few important foundation updates for our listeners. With these hard economic times upon us, some of our supporters write to say they love the radio show. They want to see it continue. They love the work of Forever Family Foundation, but they just don't have extra dollars these days to send our way. Even though we are a 100% volunteer, not-for-profit organization, it still takes a lot of money to do the work we do. And yet, we want to do so much more. So this is how everyone can help without sending us money. Go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that is taken out. And each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. But you don't have to stop there. If your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com, but first use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website, and again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon.com, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we receive a donation. And when you find your items, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. Our Holiday of the Earth raffle is in full swing. The drawing is set to be pulled on Earth Day, when five people will each win a medium reading with one of the five mediums, Bobby Allison, Laura Lynn Jackson, Lynn LeClaire, Dave Campbell, or Kathy Tao. It's $5 a chance to be in it. And unfortunately, we are unable to have the links on our website for you to purchase it through PayPal by using your credit cards. Watch the website. We're going to fix that one way or another. But meanwhile, if you'd like to get in before the raffle is drawn on April 22nd, you may send a check to Forever Family Foundation at 222 Atlantic Avenue, Oceanside, New York, 11572. And one last reminder that our weekend of afterlife exploration retreat at Transforming Grief into Hope and Understanding, May 20th to 22nd, 2011, in Chester, Connecticut, is filling up. So you might want to go visit the website, get the information on that, and reserve your spot for that weekend.
Okay, and we are talking with Dr. Iacoboni, the author of The Undying Soul. You know, doctor, how many, if any, of your patients have ever told you that they felt that, you know, their illness manifested because, you know, it was meant to happen, you know, as if it was, you know, part of a plan? Is that something that you hear often?
Well, you know, I hear that more often from the survivors. It's a little harder, I think, to be that generous when you get the disease and everything's disrupted and you succumb to the disease. But for people who get the disease and live through it, of course, it is life-changing. There's no doubt about it. And a lot has been said and written about this very subject, that if you have any kind of personal tragedy, but certainly something like cancer, where you find that everything you cared about in the material world is meaningless because you're dying, and that the only thing that's real and meaningful to you is the support of your loved ones, and then you face death in a society that refuses to acknowledge any, you know, vulnerability on the part of the people in that society except you, and then you're vulnerable, and then you overcome it. That a lot, there are all kinds of things that come out of that. Your family becomes stronger, usually. Your faith becomes quite a bit stronger. Your ability to see the world as a place where you overcome huge obstacles, as opposed to just a place where you're muddling through, occurs. And so, you know, I think it's part of the human condition to look upon the challenges in our life and make meaning out of them, as opposed to just, oh, it was a random event that there was an earthquake and half of a certain part of coastal Japan got washed away. There's more to life than that, and finding meaning in tragedy is one of the great consequences of being spiritually oriented. And it typically, and when patients start getting that way, I help them with that, because I really do think that Jesus didn't die on the cross because he wanted to entertain us. He was showing us that if you pick the most wretched, horrible way to go, and he did it with courage and grace, that he showed us that the rest of us can do it too. And he showed fear and he showed reluctance, but he went through it all. And we have to see the world as a place where there are going to be difficulties, and air conditioning and electronic vehicles and windmills aren't going to make that go away. It's still, the planet and the world is still a challenging place, and our spirit is what matters.
Mm. Well, you know, that is true, most certainly. You know, an absence of meaning usually equates to a tremendous fear. You know, I would imagine, you know, for a patient, if you believe that your life was meaningless, and here you are, combined with the fact that you may have been taught from various religions that if you did the right thing, you would prosper, so to speak.
Right.
You know, right. It's then, you know, the universe didn't hold up their end of the bargain. But I also wanted to ask you, I know we talked a little bit about near-death experiences. Any of your patients, you ever witness or they or hear about them having deathbed visions where they started talking to things that were unseen?
Just you know, not really, but what I have had conversations about are things that survivors have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who are really, really down to earth and completely uninclined to make things up to impress me or anything else. But I had one patient say to me that when his mother died, that he was told in a dream that he would see a tear in her eye when she laid in the coffin, and when he saw his mother lying in state, she had a tear in her eye. And he couldn't believe it, and he looked back, and it was gone. But he swore that it was there. I've had patients tell me that when their husband was dying, I had a woman tell me, and she was really down to earth. I don't even think she was religious. Her husband was dying a slow death. That's Philip in the book, actually. And during his last months, he had to be in a certain, he had to be on the ground floor of their cabin, and the bedroom was really upstairs. And so when he wanted her, he would knock on one of the doors and made a loud noise that she could hear from her bedroom, and she would run down and see what was wrong. Well, after he died, about a month later, really, when she was well beyond all the grieving and this, you know, vulnerability where she might hallucinate, it was the springtime, and it was the time of year when he always got out the tractor and plowed the field, and it was his happiest time of the year, and she swears that she heard him knock on the wall, even though, of course, he'd been dead for a month. And she swears it, and it's funny when people talk about these things, they don't even act like they're talking about something fantastic or unbelievable. They go, "Well, it happened,"
right? Because they know it was real.
Yeah, they know it was real. I mean, they weren't in a fog. They weren't on drugs. They weren't, that is to say, sedatives. They weren't delusional. It was just wow. He's there. You know, and they say, I feel him all the time. And the fact that he knocked on the door doesn't surprise me. I mean, the rest of us would say, well, that sounds pretty paranormal, but to them it was, just, you know, he was there.
Yeah. Well, you know, with a lot of people, it's a poor term, I think, paranormal, you know, because we always mention, you know, paranormal is very likely normal. You know, the rest of the stuff is abnormal. But
right.
What I found very interesting in the book is, you know, we often find people that have this inner knowing. You know, it transcends any book knowledge or cultural influences. They just know that they're part of a greater universe and that they're part of a life continuum. And there was one of your patients, you know, who had this knowing, and she looked at you and she said something to the effect, you know, "Doctor, you know, you'll be my professional witness as I, you know, in this dying process." And I thought that was, that must have been, in one way, surprising for you to hear. But she did have a great understanding. I mean, she had the native inner knowing, and you as a man of science were going to get to witness her passing.
Well, it was incredible, and it is an impressive thing to be with someone who has such an overpowering faith. It, for one thing, I guess it was more common when I was a kid and everyone around me was church-going and it seemed common, but nowadays it's everyone has existential, not everyone, but many of us have existential angst or some sort of self-doubt. And to be with someone who is so self-assured and yet is not a goofball or delusional or a drunk or something, but really is in total control of their lives, like the Dalai Lama, for example. And to be in the presence of someone like that is deeply moving and inspiring. And it's true that all of the characters in my book were very plain, ordinary people. Not a one of them, I think, had a college degree even. They were average people who had access to faith the way all of us do, I think. And this was later on in my journey where I was realizing that I was witnessing things that had to be talked or written about, but I didn't know how to put it all together. And then he and I became very close. You know, I made the point, this was Lyle at the end of the book, and that my other experiences had been in the realm of 9 to 15 months with these people, and Lyle went on for 4 years, and so he and I were like best friends. You know, when you work 90 hours a week and you have a family, you don't really have a social life outside of work and family, and so my social life was the clinic. And we'd sit and talk about hunting and camping and fishing and so on, and so he wanted me to witness, you know, what he was demonstrating, and I didn't know what to expect when it was going to happen, and it was quite incredible.
Do you still, you know, after all these years of practice, are you still hopeful that one day you and your colleagues will be able to conquer this disease?
No. Not in my life.
Okay. Right.
And there's a long intellectual answer to that, but I think the paradigm is all wrong. You know, I said 10 years ago, you're going to sequence the human genome. That's not going to tell you anything. And everyone thought I was crazy. Well, what did I know? Some country doctor. So they sequence the human genome, and guess what? 10 years later, what have we gotten? Nothing. Very little, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, they thought, oh, we're going to sequence the genome, and disease is directly translatable from the DNA sequence to phenotype, and it isn't. It just isn't. And oncology is foundationally based in molecular biology, and molecular biology is in total upheaval now. The central dogma is totally upheaval now. You won't hear that very often from anybody in academia because they don't want you to think that they've spent the last 50 years going in the wrong direction, but they really have. I mean, the rabbit is in the briar patch, and you're over there in the thicket, and the rabbit's not there. You know, cancer is a disease of failure of programmed cell death. It's not a disease of the DNA, which we've been thinking for 40 years. And so I think there has to be a huge paradigm shift for us to actually do what we set out to do. And, you know, academicians don't like paradigm shifts because it's very autocratic. They all have to talk party line or else they don't get promoted.
What about, you know, healing modalities, non-traditional healing modalities, just like visualization techniques and things of that nature? I mean, has that ever been integrated into your treatments, or do you think there's value to it?
Well, the answer to the first question is no, not really, and so then I don't have much of an opinion about it. And it's not because I'm not interested, but when you work among farmers and miners and lumberjacks, which is what I've been doing for the last 30 years, you know, out in rural America. I tried actually some of that stuff, and they all thought I was kooky, you know. They don't get into any of that fringe stuff, even though I have a lot of fringe credentials. I mean, I went to school in Berkeley and went to college in Los Angeles and came of age in the 60s, and never did anything very fringe or kooky, but I mean, at least I was in the culture when that happened, when all this was going on, Tommy.
Right.
But anyway, Timothy Leary. But so they kind of were unreceptive to it, and so I kind of backed off from that. And I so that's part of the reason why my discovery and my emphasis is going back to traditional ancient faith. And, you know, if you think about, has the human race been wrong, you know, for its entire existence? Ever since it got civilized and had the revelations on all the different continents, all the different great religions, it's hard to imagine that it was a misguided group of slightly more intelligent apes with good fingers that could, you know, make tools and conquer the world. I don't think so. I think there's no reason to discard ancient faith. And when you look at all of the religions, they all are pretty similar. You know, they're all couched in their own cultural milieu, but there has not ever been a group of humans whose native inclination was non-spiritual. When you go to the Aborigines or South America or Native Americans, the North Pole, the Eskimos, it is part of the human condition to be spiritual and to believe in an afterlife. That's just what we are.
Yeah, I think that we have a lot to learn from the ancients. Not only were they more in touch with their spiritual side, but very well they had some knowledge that could help us in healing that we may one day rediscover. We have been talking with Dr. Stephen Iacoboni, the author of The Undying Soul, A Cancer Doctor's Discovery. The website for more information about his book is theundyingsoul.com. As we mentioned, we do have an Amazon link to The Undying Soul on our website, which if you feel like purchasing the book. And it's been a pleasure talking with you, I would hope that we get to talk with you again soon.
Well, Bob, it's been a great pleasure. I'd be glad to talk to you again at any time. I'm going to get onto your website and learn more about it. And thanks again for having me.
Okay, thank you, and continued good work.
Okay, thanks. You too, Bob.
All right, take care.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Chuck Rocket, Vicky Steffi, Janet Mayer, Judith Lachman, Wendy Lippo, Kathleen Murray. And let's give our energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures in Mexico Gulf by praying like this. To the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, planktons, corals, algae, and all creatures in our Gulf of Mexico, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. That was by Masuro Emoto, May 9, 2010.
And our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.